When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix. No Howard Beck this week. He is off on assignment at an undisclosed location. But since we are less than a couple of weeks away from the NBA's trade deadline, I want to bring in somebody that has a lot of experience dealing with the NBA trade deadline. Billy King, former general manager of the Brooklyn Nets, Philadelphia 76ers, joining us with his Eagles jacket on, the pride of Philadelphia right now. Billy, what's up, man?
Not much. How are you? Yes, I figured, you know, you being a Boston guy, figured I'd rub it in because you guys, it's going to be a while before you guys get back there with being a Patriot fan.
By the way, I don't know if you caught what happened in New York yesterday, where in New York, the Empire State Building
went green,
lit up an Eagles color. What the fuck is that? Are you kidding me? I mean, get out. I'm not a native New Yorker, but I did live there for more than 10 years. If I was a Giants or Jets fan and I saw that, I would have gone and thrown rocks at those lights to get them to go off.
I think they were just supporting the NFC and I don't know what they were doing.
The I-95 corridor? Like, what are we supporting?
Exactly.
Like, that didn't... I want to know whose genius idea that was to...
Yeah. If that had been reversed and it had been like the Giants ran in Philadelphia did that, that building would not be there today. I guarantee you.
I don't understand that. I don't know why anyone thought that was a good idea. I don't know why anyone thought it would be a good idea to tweet the picture of it. Like, that was going to get positive responses. Yeah. It was wild. It was wild seeing that last night. Before I get into specific teams that I want to talk about this deadline, all your experiences going into previous deadlines, what's the one that stands out the most? Because I'd imagine the pursuit of Carmelo has to be one that was particularly heartburn-inducing over the course of the weeks before that.
That one was just dragged out so long, and it was so public. And I think so many people got information, and that's what I didn't like about it. Everything was just public, and whether it was right or wrong information, it was out there. Probably for me, though, the deal that I probably go back to the Dikembe deal in Philadelphia, when we, at the deadline, we had the best record in the East. Theo Ratliff breaks his wrist, and now we got to make a decision. Do we wait for him to come back from surgery? How long is it going to be? Can we keep that run going to get to the finals, or do we trade for Dikembe? And Larry wanted to trade for Dikembe, I want to say, in November. And I was Larry Brown, and I kept putting them off. Said, no, we're winning, like, with best record knees. But once that happened with Theo, I said I wasn't sure when he's going to get back and to get have a chance to get Dikembe, knowing that if you do go to the finals, you may play a Shaq. He'd give you the best chance. So we traded Tony Kukoc, Nazi Muhammad, Pepe Sanchez, I think, and that was in the deal for Dikembe, and that gave us the center to help us, and it was risky because we were the best record in the East at the time.
Yeah, it's almost harder to make a deal when you're really good than when you're really bad. I would assume. Yeah, So
yeah, when you're bad, it's easy. You just make trades, and if you get two more wins than what you had, like, it's a successful trade.
just wheel and deal left and right. Yeah. All right, before we get into some of the teams I want to talk about, I want to start and get your take on the news of the week. It involves LeBron James, who is not at all happy, Billy, with NBA referees. James was livid at the end of Saturday's game against Boston after the officials missed a late game foul by Jason Tatum on a drive to the basket. Here's LeBron after the game on this and other non-calls that have gone against him this season.
It's challenging. Very challenging. I don't get it. I don't get it. I'm attacking the paint just as much as any of the other guys in this league that's shooting double-digit free throws a night. And, you know, I don't get it. I don't understand it. I mean, you guys seen some of the games that we've lost this year with late-game missed calls. We had an opportunity to literally, you know, win the game. I mean, that's, you know, I had this second one in the last few weeks for myself, you know, against Dallas, had an opportunity to win the game if the foul was called. K-9 the other day had an opportunity to tie the game if, you know, the four-point play is called. You know, I don't understand. I don't understand what we're doing. And I watch basketball every single day. I watch these games every single day, and I don't see it happening to nobody else. It's just weird.
So, Billy, how significant is this? The referees were quick to acknowledge they blew it, and the NBA, of course, will happily share data that shows referees are very often right, but this is the NBA's biggest star putting a spotlight on the referees. What, if any, impact do you think this will have?
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate it happened. And I do like the fact that Eric Lewis is the crew chief. They came out and acknowledged we blew it. You know, because before, they never would come out and say that, they, you know, it would be that mystery what happened that play. Unfortunately, they're human beings. That's what you're dealing with. And anytime the human beings, calls are going to be missed. And I think players, as a general manager, I used to get upset with it too. And then as a player, LeBron's got to realize, yes, that cost you the game. But there's probably more plays throughout that game that cost them the game. There was turnovers. There was missed shots. There were bad plays on the Lakers' part that if they make two or three of them different, that call doesn't matter. Despite that, I think he had to move on. And LeBron's got he made a statement and just move on from it. And they're going to be missed calls the rest of the year. They're going to miss calls in the playoffs. That's the nature of sports. And instant replay has helped it because you're able to get some right. But on that play, you couldn't go back to replay because there was no call to be made.
So what do you think about that, though? That was kind of my takeaway. I mean, one adjustment that could be made next season through the competition committee is to say last 2 minutes of a game, non-calls, questionable non-calls are reviewable and they can be reversed. Do you think that is a option that could or should be explored?
I would like to see it more of take it out of the coach's hands for a challenge, take it right to New York, almost like the NFL does in the final minutes. And the final minute of the game, if New York sees a play that is so egregious like that one, they can stop the play and say, yes, that's you know, we're going to review that. You missed a call. Now they'd have to look at it because if plays going and, you know, if they come, if that would have been like a transition and now Boston got the balls going the other way, how do you stop it and prevent them from getting a layup? Those are things you got to figure out. But I'd like to see if they could explore maybe the final minutes of situations like that where, you know, maybe there's a buzzer that the referees have like they do in football. And that final minute, they just get a buzz like, oh, that's reviewable once you go take a look at this. Because I think if you have replay, you got to be – the point of replay is to try to get it right so you don't have this situation. So I would love to see them explore it. I don't want the games to go longer because they are long, but they've got to explore a way maybe that it comes from the league office in New York and the replay center.
Well, that's the trade-off, right? Because, you know, the NBA is obviously very concerned about flow of the game issues. It's why they eliminated – the referee initiated replay on out of bounds violations last year because, I mean, God, sitting there for some of those games, it seemed like three or four times in the last 2 minutes you'd have out of bounds violations reviewed. And that really, you know, gummed up the end of game situation. You make a good point. Like, what happens, you know, if that ball's still in play and a timeout isn't called, you know, how do you handle that particular situation? But I do, look, not to defend LeBron here, but I do understand where he's coming from. I was in LA sitting there during that, what was it, a double overtime game against Dallas, where I think it was the end of regulation. He was pretty clearly fouled by Christian Wood at the end of that game. And he's one of those players, Billy, that, you know, like Shaq during his heyday, you know, Carmelo was kind of the same way. He draws so much contact that I think sometimes referees just don't know how much of it to call, because every time LeBron goes to the basket, and by the way, shout out to LeBron, that was a great drive to the basket. He went left on that drive, blew by Malcolm Brogdon, who's a good defender. And my biggest issue with that non-call was not Eric Lewis, but there was another referee right there, like on the baseline, right there. And it happened right in front of him. And I get it. We have the benefit of slow motion. We have the benefit of hindsight. But if you're a professional referee, you got to call that. Like, that is a pretty clear-cut foul.
And you do, but I'd like to see sometimes, was there a player in his line of vision? If he's on the baseline, like you said, he can see it. Did a player go by it? You know, because a lot of time, there was a game I remember we were playing when I was in Brooklyn, we were playing Miami, and there was a clear foul into the game, inbound play. But the referee, his positioning, there was no way he can see it. I remember calling the league, said, look, it's a blown call, but, and I won't say the referee's name, but that there's no way he could have saw it because from his position. So I said, maybe you guys need to look at positioning on inbounds play to referee so they do get a better angle. And that's the only thing where, because it was so obvious to me, something had to block the vision or something that he couldn't see it. That's the only way I could say. And to go back to, I know I made that point about the replay, and that's great. But now that one was so obvious. If they're not obvious, and now you're stopping play from the league office, then, well, we got to take a look at it. Maybe a foul, may not be a foul. Now you're taking away a transition. So it's going to be a hard situation for the league to step in on that. But maybe that's one at the end of the game. If it's at the final buzzer, if the league sees something, then they can come in. Maybe it's at the final buzzer that they see something, they can do it. Maybe it's only on that play. And then everybody's like, what about the previous play? And, you know, but maybe it's just on the final play.
What are those What are those phone calls like? You know, if you're what kind of response is Rob Pelinka getting today if he's on the phone with Joe Dumars or Monty McCutcheon or whoever he might be talking to at the league office? Like, what if, like, the league knows it's a foul? Like, would it just be Rob Pelinka venting at this point, or is there something constructive that comes from those phone calls?
Well, it could be him venting, but if he has another point of view, like I did, like maybe to try to say that, you know, his positioning wasn't right or there's other things. But from the league standpoint, they're going to say, yeah, we missed it. You know, there's nothing we can say. Yeah, Rob, you know, and they're going to say, why? What did he say afterwards? They said that, and they may give a little better explanation of why they missed it. And that's where you could get that from the league. The best one is when Rod Thorne was in the position, because Rod would say, yeah, we missed it. But he would come back and say, but those three or four free throws you missed previous possession, you could have won the game. You made your free throws or you didn't turn it over, which he was right, though, because usually it's not that one play that cost the Lakers that game. It did because of the fact he would have been on a line of free throws. But a couple more plays or something throughout the fourth quarter, they make different. They might are in that position. So that's the hardest thing. It's you're dealing with human beings. And you, if you watch football, it's the same thing in football. You know, yesterday, you know, sideline Kansas City, they're running down the, you know, Mahomes is going out of bounds and he pushed him. It was definitely a, you know, late hit out of bounds. They win the game. Now, is that the referee's fault or is that the player's fault for pushing him out of bounds?
Yeah. Now, it really sounds like there's no easy answer to this other than try to make as fewer mistakes as you can in those situations. All right. Let's talk about a couple of teams here at crossroads as we get to the NBA trade deadline. The Bulls right now, as we record this, are 10th in the Eastern Conference. They are not a serious contender. Lonzo Ball has been out all season long, and Billy Donovan said recently he is nowhere near playing. So I would expect Lonzo at some point around the All-Star break to be ruled out for the rest of the year. You also can't look at the Bulls roster and say it has this enormous upside for years to come. They don't shoot the three. They don't rebound. Defense has been slipping the last few weeks. This was a roster, Billy, to me, that was constructed to effectively end a four-year playoff drought. But it always felt kind of a cut below real contender status. So here the Bulls are with Nikola Vucevic on an expiring contract, with DeMar DeRozan with 1 year left in his contract, with a lot of teams interested in Alex Caruso. And remember, this is all, you know, this all is playing out with the backdrop of the Chicago owing Orlando a top four protected first round pick this year. So if you're Arturis Karnisovich, how are you approaching this year's deadline?
Well, I'm looking to see which players I want to have back next year that we're going to build with next year. Because this season, you know, there's no way they're even going to win a championship. They're trying to just get into the play, make sure to stay in the playing game. So now I'm looking at what are we going to have back next year? If a guy's expiring, can we get something that'll help us next year going forward? If not, I'm not trading him just to be trading him. So that's, you got to go through the roster and find out which of the guys you want to keep, which guys you aren't going to have. Is DeRozan in your future? Probably not, because I don't think even with Ball come back next year, where are they going to be a contender next year? So now maybe I look to move him, but I'm trying to get as many young pieces, picks, whatever that can help us build for the future.
Yeah, to me, Vucevic is where you kind of have to start, because I would be really afraid of giving Vucevic a long-term deal in the summer. Yeah. Like, I mean, he's done this now twice, where when he's been in a contract year, he's been a monster. And in between, not so much. I look at him, you know, over 30, good player, don't get me wrong, but I don't look at him as being someone you want to commit like a 4 or 5 year deal over the course of it. He'd be where I'd start. DeRozan too. I guess here's the question. Like, how much do you worry about that top four pick, or that potential top four protected pick conveying in this situation?
You do, because if you traded, if you're Arturis, so that that bothers you. When I got fired in Brooklyn, Sean Marks didn't really care about the ones I'd already traded for the swaps, because it wasn't on his watch. So if you're Arturis, you're looking at it, because if you trade one and ends up being the number two pick this draft, and because you made the team a little worse this year, they're going to look right at you. So, but I think by trading some pieces, maybe getting some younger pieces, like you said, start with Vucevic. What can you get for him to build? And maybe it's a pick that gets you some young players, somebody else. Maybe it ends up being a three-way deal to build for the future. And I say build for the future, there'll be young pieces that can come in and play right away that you're trading for. So you got to find other teams in the same situation, whether it's a Toronto, you know, that may feel like, hey, we got to do something because this is not going the way we want it to be. You know, maybe it's Charlotte, maybe it's Orlando. You know, you talk to some of those teams and try to figure out some deals. Maybe you go back to Orlando, do another deal where that pick now, instead of top four, it's top 10 protected. Yeah, because you do another deal with them or something, not just boosting, but with something else. You try to explore all the opportunities to help your team for the future, but, you know, where you don't end up. That's why I said you don't just give everybody away. You start with like the Vucevic, the DeRozans, and maybe bring some. Because what's going to happen as the season goes on, Vucevic, if he does that trade, is going to say, okay, I'm going to rest because I am in a free agent. I don't want to get hurt. DeRozan is going to say, you know, I'm older. He's going to start taking the year off at the end of the season. So if you got younger players that are going to be that you trade for, that are willing to play, give higher energy, maybe you do steal some games later in the year.
How risky a player do you look at Zach LaVine being? Because I had one executive say to me recently that he looks at Zach LaVine as maybe being the most risky player potentially on the trade block because of that knee and the history of problems he's had with it, and a big contract that, if you project out and look at, you know, changes in the collective bargaining agreement, you don't know how much, what percentage of your books going to be taken up by that contract. When you look at LaVine specifically, like, how big a risk would he be for teams exploring acquiring him?
It'd be a big risk if you're just adding salary. If you're exchanging salary and not, you know, maybe exchanging a player that's very similar contract-wise, age-wise, and they just need to change the scenery, yeah. But I wouldn't give up two or three picks or a couple picks and some young, just to think, okay, because I like LaVine, but I don't think he's your franchise player. He's your guy. He's probably the number two. If you had with another franchise guy, it could be good. So I'd be very careful what you're giving up for him going forward, because like you said, all those things come into play. And as good a player as he hasn't really won a lot in his career. He just mentioned Vucevic hasn't really won a lot in his career. They've got great numbers and great stats. So at some point, you got to look at the guys that have won at this point in their careers.
I just don't get what the strategy was with all this. You know, like I said, you get all these guys and you end a playoff drought, but like the Chicago Bulls shouldn't be worrying about ending a playoff drought. Like the Sacramento Kings should worry about ending a playoff drought. Like the Chicago Bulls are a big market team that theoretically should have the ability to, you know, build a championship contender. You know, going to get Vucevic, who in Orlando was a good player, but not a great one. Granted, the Lonzo Ball injury killed them. If you look back at what they were before Ball went out in January of 2022, they were a really good team. But even Billy Donovan admitted this recently. Like, there may have been some lightning in a bottle to that team with all the shots DeRozan made, with the way Lonzo played early on. I look at this team and it's like, I never thought they had even an outside chance of being anything more than a second round team. And that kind of befuddles me a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, and having sat in both seats where you're trying to win and like, you know, you make trades thinking, okay, add these pieces, it's going to help us win. And you think it's all going to work. The hardest thing is bringing players in and trying to get it to come together and work. And especially in a short amount of time. Traditionally in the NBA, if you build through the draft and you draft and you get your young guys to a point, you may then can sign a free agent or add a veteran in to the nucleus to make it work. But if you look at Miami, you know, Pat's done it and Andy done a great job done every year. They find guys that nobody wants. They develop their own and they've rebuilt it three or four times down there. Golden State, you know, that was pretty much built through the draft. They added Iguodala with a free agent. They added Durant, but that was after he'd already won it, but they built the draft and then you add to that. So that's the hard thing I think with Chicago is that they were, you know, you're trying to do it on the fly with a lot of traded pieces, and it's really hard to do it when you're trading and building a team that way.
Yeah, I mean, that Vucevic trade, it could turn out to be a disaster if you look back on it a few years, because they already gave up one pick and that turned out to be Franz Wagner, who is really good. Yeah. They traded Wendell Carter in that deal. He's averaging 15, 9, and shooting like 36% from three. And then you got this other pick that's looming out there, which could be top 10 at the very least. So that, you know, we might look back at that deal as being catastrophic for Chicago. The guy that I think, you know, is going to generate real interest that Chicago should capitalize on is Alex Caruso, who is like a really good two-way player, defends multiple positions, shoots the three really well. Is paid like, I think he's like $9 million per year or something like that over the next 2 years. So he's got a great contract, which makes him very movable. To me, Billy, he'd be someone that I would dangle out there because he's not probably not part of your long-term situation there. And if he can bring back a first-round pick, maybe something a little bit more, because I think there's going to be a lot of teams out there, whether it's Dallas, Phoenix, whomever, that would love to get their hands on a player like that.
Yeah, the hard thing is the market got screwed up last summer with what value was placed on players being traded. Mm-hmm. When Rudy Gobert gets five first round picks, you know, and then other guys. So now everybody's like, well, if I'm trading this, I got to get at least three or four. So the value system is
sort San Antonio was looking at like two for Jakob Poeltl for a while. I don't think that's going to happen, but you know, everybody's looking at not just one, multiple first round picks.
Because it's the market changed drastically last summer with, you know, what people asked for and got. And then the problem is Oklahoma City still holds a bunch of picks. There's a couple teams that holds a bunch of people's picks. So there's not, and some teams
New Orleans,
have no picks.
Oklahoma City, New Orleans, there's got to be one draft in the next 3 years that they have all the picks.
They have all the picks and they have young players that they're building with in the draft too. They're not going to be able to add all these players. So it's going to be interesting.
They're both in great positions. I mean, the Pelicans are more advanced, obviously, with Zion Ingram, and they're a would-be contender this year where you wonder if they might add some of that mix. But I mean, I spent some time in Oklahoma City the last couple of weeks. I mean, Shea is a beast. Like, he is a legit number one option on that team. Then we'll see what Chet is next year, who else they get in this draft. But I like the position that both those teams are in right now. All right, you mentioned Toronto, and I want to talk about where the Raptors are right now. A game behind the Bulls as we record this. They blew up a playoff team for 1 year of Kawhi Leonard, and it worked. So they have operated pretty ambitiously in the past. And look, there's a title banner hanging because of that. But this team, Billy, has has really not been able to gain traction all season long. Their defense is struggling. There are some indications, it seems like, that the team may not be responding to Nick Nurse anymore. If you are Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster in that Raptors front office, are you operating as a buyer or are you operating as a seller or do you do nothing at this trade deadline?
Well, I don't think there's a trade they can make that's going to put them in the top echelon in the East. Because a lot of people don't have those players available that you can say, we can give up this. And so now I may be trying to tinker a little bit to add a piece to two, maybe they can get us in that play in. But if not, I'm not trying to give up assets or things that's going to affect our future. And then when the season's over, then you have a chance to sit down and evaluate everything, the coaches, the players, and then you make decisions based on building for next season, because they still have two very good young players. They had some injuries this year. So now maybe this is a year you say, look, we're going to take a step back, take a deep breath and realize what do we have going for next year, and make the trades that if you need to make some in the offseason. But I wouldn't do anything drastic there because I don't know. There's not a deal out there you can say you could make that's going to put them where they're now. They're competing with Milwaukee and Philadelphia and Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, and that may be enough of a reason to hold on to OG Anunoby unless you get, you know, unless you get a Gobert, Donovan Mitchell type offer, you hold on to him. I mean, he's incredibly valuable. 25 years old, 6'7", two-way player, good contract. That's the kind of guy teams are salivating over. The two guys, though, that I think they have to make some decisions on, Fred VanVleet is one of them. He's 28 years old. He's an all-star. He's got a player option. He's going to decline at the end of the season. He's played some heavy minutes in the last few years. Always one of the minutes leaders in the NBA. Is he the kind of guy that you'd feel comfortable committing $25, $30 million per year to in the next contract? Because, you know, he already turned down a four-year, $114 million contract extension, which, understandably, that's based on his previous contract. He thinks he's outplayed that contract. But if he's looking for 4 years, 150 or whatever it is, the max number they can offer him, is that the kind of deal you'd be comfortable paying Fred VanVleet?
Not if I'm Toronto, no. Just because I think you look at your team age-wise, you look where he's at age-wise, and you look at where you are now team-wise. They still need pieces to help them get back to where they want to be. And so that's where, and I don't know if he's that piece. I just say that I don't know if I'd want to commit long-term that kind of money, because once you do, you're locked into him as your point guard going out to when he's, you know, now 30, 32 years old. So I would not be comfortable with that. And that's why if something came along trade the line that made sense, but otherwise you can explore sign and trade with them. But the biggest mistake I think franchises sometimes can make is signing is being afraid to hang on to a guy because he may walk. And so you make a deal, bring guys back that you don't want. And now you're stuck with guys that you got to try to move again. So if you can do a deal where the contracts come back that are friendlier to you and help you, maybe you get two players for one. Yeah, but otherwise, I think you got to – they're in a particular position where they got to be cautious because you're close enough where you can add a player or two in the offseason that helps you move up. Or you can do something to damage it where you can move further down next year.
So how much does the fear of guys walking play into all this? Because I know that's a prevalent, you know, fear in the minds of a lot of front office executives. I mean, I look at Dallas, like I think it's more likely than not that they move Christian Wood if they can't get him signed to an extension in the next couple of weeks because they don't want to see him, you know, go for nothing, just like they saw Jalen Brunson go for nothing. And we're going to talk about Dallas in a second, but like that was a catastrophic might be too strong, but that's bad for the Mavericks that Jalen Brunson is not there right now. But like, you know, losing guys for nothing. I mean, how much does that factor into your mind as you kind of look at a trade deadline?
Well, I mean, I was in Brooklyn, go to Brooklyn, for example. With Darren Williams, we traded for, I felt pretty confident just based on the relationship I had that we could re-sign him. Felt pretty confident with Brooke Lopez and Thaddeus Young, who we trade Garnett for to get Thaddeus, and they both are free agents at the time. I felt comfortable that we could re-sign them. So I think you got to know your relationship with your player, and they give you signs. I think all the signs pointed to Jalen Brunson leaving to go to New York. from the outside. I was going to be shocked if he was not going to be in New York, just in what I knew. So I think they had to read those same tea leaves. Even though I know a lot of people were saying that about Darren Williams, that he's going to go back to Dallas. I have one of our minority owners call me in the deadline. You got to trade him. He's leaving. Trade him right now. Like I said, no. That's where the relationship is. You got to have a good understanding of the relationship with the player. Because you don't want to lose players for nothing, but also you don't want to be held hostage where you do a bad deal, because sometimes losing a player for nothing is better than taking on contracts in a trade that you can't move or do anything with later.
By the way, how about the fact that Brook Lopez is arguably the defensive player of the year 10 years after that Darren Williams, Joe Johnson, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett team was put together? 10 years later, and we're talking about Brook Lopez as defensive player of the year.
I mean, it's. I love Brook and always loved him when he was in playing for him in Brooklyn. Great guy. And he had a knack for shot blocking the ability. But now his game is telling me he's a three-point shooter and a shot blocker, which is I'm happy for him because he took a lot of heat from, you know, saying he couldn't rebound, couldn't block shots, too soft. But now he's still playing and helping the team win rings.
Also, he was in every public trade talk that was out there. How many conversations did you have to have with Brook Lopez about trade talks?
Brooke and I, we had a very open, candid conversation. And I told him, I said, Brooke, you're going to hear your name out there, a lot of things. And I told him, I said, honestly, Brooke, the deal with Dwight Howard, that I would do something there. I said, there's nothing against you. I think Dwight, at this point in his career, is a little further along and where we need to go. But otherwise, your name, if it's mentioned with anybody else, don't believe it. And I said, and even with Orlando, I said, I will come to you if something's close. If I think we got a deal, I will come to you. Otherwise, don't worry about it. And I said, I'm not trading you for anybody else. So don't worry about anything else you read. And he appreciated it. But we talked all the time about it. And I still talk to him to this day. So,
I mean, did you have to go to him about the Dwight stuff? Because that, I mean, everybody remembers the Dwight mayor that was down there. Yeah. But like, that was close. I mean, that was pretty close.
Well, but it was close to the point where the next morning, actually trade deadline day, I was going to call him and let him know that I think we got it done. And then Dwight opted in.
From the outside, that was one of the more bizarre situations that I've covered. Did that feel bizarre on the inside?
It was, because I went to bed the night before saying, okay, we got Dwight Howard. We're going to talk to Orlando in the morning, and we're going to, they're going to consummate the deal. They got the deal points. It was going to go over one more time, and they're going to sign off on it. And I woke up, and I never forget, I got a phone call from a text reporter saying, did you hear Dwight Howard opted in? And I said, no. And I remember calling the guy, rest his soul, Dan Fagan, and he goes, news to me. And I remember calling Otis Smith down in Orlando. I said, did Dwight opt in? He goes, people are saying that, but I haven't seen anything. So let's keep working on the deal until I know for sure. And then he called me back like 40 minutes later. So, yep, he opted in.
First of all, rest in peace, Dan Fagan, who had some crazy clients over the years, had some crazy situations unfold with his clients over the years. Aha, love a good trip down the Dwight Howard memory lane. Last team I want to talk to you about, Billy, is the Dallas Mavericks, who I referenced earlier. Luka Doncic is having a MVP caliber season, but he's not getting a lot of help from that team. They certainly don't look like the Western Conference finalists they were a year ago. They let Jalen Brunson go. They've got a decision to make on Christian Wood. Luka's signed through the 25-26 season, so there's not a sense of urgency right now about improving. But, you know, we've seen over the last few years that a guy doesn't have to be in a contract year to make noise and to force an issue with a team. How concerned concerned might be the wrong word, but like upgrading that team, how pressing do you think it should be for Dallas to make a deal before the deadline?
I think it's pressing, but to the sense just to put yourself in position to try to, because with Luka, you've got a shot because he's that good. And so if you can add a piece that can give you some more experience, especially playoff experience, you add it. But the offseason is going to be important for them because, as you said, eventually he's going to say, I can't do this alone. I can't do this by myself. But no one's ever challenged a Mark Cuban and say, I want out. You got to trade me. So it'll be interesting to see that. Mark has a great relationship with his players. But I do – players eventually will get – you know, they'll go back when the season's over, when they're able to reflect on the year and say, wait a minute. And, you know, they start, you know, maybe even watch some tape. Man, I have no help. I'm doing all this on my own. And other players and other teams will tell them, you got to get out of there. You're not giving you help. So they can't let it linger, and it's got to start this offseason. If you can help, the hard thing is during the season, everybody knows you need help. So it's hard to get that deal because everybody's going to hold you hostage. You got to give me more and more. So if you can always say maybe tinker and also wait around the waiver wire, because guys, some veteran guys will get cut. You can sign some guys and maybe add that piece. But the offseason this year, I think, will be key for them to show Luka that they're committed to trying to win, build around him.
And just like it was in 2010, 2011, I don't think they need like a second player of Luka's caliber. I don't even think they need, they may not even need a second all-star. Maybe somebody like, I mean, they're kind of in the same situation as I mentioned, Dirk and the guys around him. Giannis is another great example. Chris Middleton has been an all-star, but he's not, you wouldn't call him a top 10 player in the league. They just need kind of like a couple of guys like that. Brunson might've been that guy. I mean, Brunson could be an all-star this year. And yeah, I mean, like, if you look back at it, when we look back at all this, like, not giving him a 4-year extension early on when they could have is one of those, like, insane mistakes that you could make. And then, look, not paying him, like, not saying, like, we talked about it a minute ago, but, and I agree with you, he had eyes on New York. He wanted to be there, bigger role, dad on the coaching staff. But if Dallas had stepped to the table with a max level contract, I think he probably would have taken that as well. Like, you need guys like that, you know, around Luka to have success.
Well, and I think you need guys like that because you put guys around him, they become all-stars. Like you said, Giannis, a lot of guys who play with Giannis become all-stars around Giannis, Brooke Lopez, Chris Middleton. A lot of guys playing with Steph Curry become all-stars. When you put good players, like Michael Jordan made a lot of guys' careers and made them all-stars and household names because you put good players around great players, those great players will make those other players very good players and become all-stars.
No, I agree with you. I think he just needs, second tier stars around him with specific roles, like shooters, guys that can shoot it, and that you have to the point where you can just he can face more single teams every night rather than a consistent array of double and triple teams. It's
and guys got to understand their role though when they're coming in that it's Luka's team. You're there to support him, and you know, like we 2001 Allen, all those guys realize that it's Allen's show. We're just here to support him, and they were okay with it.
It's going to be interesting playoffs. I mean, I mentioned this to you in an email, but like it feels like this has got to be the most parity that the NBA's had in a long time. And I would imagine, and you know the league office, Adam Silver, better than I do, but like this, as much as super teams drive finals ratings, this has got to be what the NBA wants, right? Like they want to go into a postseason with, you know, 8 or 9 teams legitimately having a chance to win.
There is a lot of people that have a legitimate chance to win. And I think this is what the league wants. The league wants this parity, but it's also the teams that are winning or teams that are paying those tax dollars too. If you look at a lot of those teams, they're paying a lot. So I think what Adam would like to see is not as many teams spending that much money and winning, because then it tells those small market teams that you really don't, if you don't spend at that level, you don't have a chance to win. That's the problem that the league is facing. Golden State's, the Philadelphia's, the Brooklyn's. I mean, where their payrolls are now, they're winning. The Indiana's, the smaller Detroit, those teams are, you know, they've either got to take their payroll way up there or they're not going to win. It's hard to do that in a small market.
Yeah, that's why we're hearing that chatter about, you know, hard cap and high-end salary. And I've talked to people about this. I don't think the NBA is going to go to the mat for that in collective bargaining because the risk of a lockout or a work stoppage is it's not worth the reward of what they get. Like you can't slow this momentum with a TV deal coming up in a couple of years. Like that just, I don't see that ultimately happening, but Golden State, they're spending, they'd make you blush, Billy, you know, and Mikhail Prokhorov blush with what they're spending, you know, right now. That's a lot of money.
They're spending a lot of money. And it's one where that'd be a lot of money to me, to be able to say, because if you don't win, you still got to face the owner. Like, okay, we signed off on this, but we didn't win.
Well, maybe Bob Myers doesn't have to face the owner after this year.
Exactly. So
that's a conversation for another day. Billy King, former general manager, Nets and 76ers. Always good to talk to you, man. Good luck to your Eagles in a couple of weeks. I'm sure that the Empire State Building will be ready and ready to go with Eagles colors once again.
We appreciate their support up there in New York.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster.
That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.